Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is July 20th, 2018, and this is episode 95. Politicoast is the BC Politics Podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Delenboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we have an extended interview that we did earlier this week with Green MLA Adam Olson on all things salmon. It was fun. He's fun. You'll enjoy it, I hope. Patrons have probably heard it already, maybe. We're also going to do some catch-up on the latest BC politics news. We haven't actually been sitting down in the quote-unquote studio for a couple weeks, so things keep happening. And then Trudeau just shuffled his cabinet this week, so we'll also touch in on that. As always, we're going to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodsons, for helping make the show possible. And also make sure you check out BC Today. They're going to be on vacation next week, but following that, you can sign up for the daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. You can get your free trial to get unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners use the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate just for you. For your free two-week trial, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca.
We got a little bit of feedback from some of our listeners about the new music at the beginning of the show.
I put a new song in on episode 90, I think, and it's a slight remix of a like 70s folk song just called British Columbia. And someone on Twitter really doesn't like it, but someone commented on our website, which we've never actually, I think, told people that you can do. You can go to politicoast.ca, find an episode, and like leave a comment in the notes there.
In fact, you should be doing that because this is the first feedback we've had in quite a while.
Yeah, so I think we've had 3 comments in 97 episodes or so.
We should get more feedback and you should be sending it to us.
So it's a divisive jingle.
I like it.
If people really don't like it, we could actually just commission an actual musician to do something for us. But
might need a little more Patreon money for that.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. Give us your feedback. Let us know what you think of that music or if we should do something else. The other thing we want your ideas for is we're on episode 95, and that means episode 100 is coming up soon. We haven't done anything big since, well, I guess we did the Christmas special, but we haven't done anything live or in person since episode 50, and we should do something big and fun. I just had a Canby Report live show last night at the Belmont. We had 65 people there or something like that, and it was awesome. So we should do a Politicoast 100th episode spectacular. We don't have a plan yet. We're thinking maybe Victoria, if you're on the island and think we should do something like that around our 100th episode will be like August 23rd. So let us know if that sounds like a good idea.
Or if you're in Vancouver and don't want to travel, also let us know. You know, just send us some feedback on this one.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. We have some dream guest ideas that I don't know if will happen, but we'll try and find some more realistic ones if we can't make that happen. But yeah, send us ideas at PoliticoastPod. First up, let's go into our interview with Adam Olson on salmon. I know I learned things in this and had a good time. Welcome to the Politicoast, Adam Olson. Thanks for joining us to talk about salmon issues.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a very exciting, beautiful day here in sunny Vancouver, and happy to be on the show.
Maybe you could start off by just giving us a bit of a background on your own passion and concern. I know you've been talking a lot in the legislature this last session about salmon issues. Is this something you've cared about for a long time, and where does that come from?
Yeah, so I represent Saanich North and the Islands in the legislature, one of the three Greens, and grew up with, you know, salmon in my blood, really. I am a mixed heritage guy. My father's Coast Salish, Saanich people, based in the riding that I'm from, or that I represent. And we come from a long line of fisher people, and my name, the Hunup, which is my traditional Coast Salish name, is very strongly associated to fishing locations in the Salish Sea, as sockeye, chinook, salmon locations. And so, you know, I have it on my wedding ring. It was featured heavily in my campaign as part of my logo. I come by salmon honestly. And so when I got elected into the legislature I recognize the opportunity that salmon present both, well, actually not both, but on an economic, social, and environmental, in those three paradigms, and recognized, you know, very quickly, and knew this all along, actually, that if you're doing good salmon policy, if you're creating good salmon public policy, then you're also creating good environmental, social, and economic policy. And so for me, it was something that I wanted to come in focus on. And throughout the spring session, I don't know that I went 2 or 3 days without standing in the legislature speaking about wild Pacific salmon in some context.
Well, what is the role that the various salmon species play in BC's economy and ecosystem?
Well, it's very, very broad in almost every part. From a historical perspective, if we go back prior to contact, salmon are not just culturally important for the coastal First Nations, but all the way into the interior First Nations as well. The wild Pacific salmon chetnuk, as they're known from where I'm from, are incredibly important to the culture. The entire social structure of the Saanich people, for example, is built around the fishery and the relationship that the people had with the salmon. From a provincial perspective, it's one of the, you know, four founding industries of our province. This is after contact. There's, you know, many, many stories written about the salmon fishery and its heyday through the, you know, 20th century. And as we come into the 21st century, we know that there's been a crash in Pacific salmon stocks, in most rivers and our creeks and streams in our province. And, as we started to do the work and looking into why there's a broad range of issues. And in fact, most of them are issues in which I'm the critic for that ministry. So we Greens only have three of us. So I'm a critic for seven different ministries, and nearly every ministry that I'm a critic of, salmon play a role. And that was part of the reason why it was also a natural fit for me to take on these issues within the legislature.
I want to get into that decline and just quantify that a bit. But before we do that, we mentioned the economic importance. And I think people often think of fisheries and those kind of activities as economically important on the coast. But the way salmon travel upstream, it's kind of been an economic and cultural factor for people in, I think, every corner of the province. I imagine that's true, correct? And sort of related to that, could you maybe just touch briefly on how salmon sort of interact with the broader ecosystem, like how changes in the stock affect, you know, grizzly bears in the interior and orcas in the ocean and other life in this province?
Well, in fact, I mean, it's interesting because you're absolutely right. I was just in a committee meeting and we were talking about the value add of, you know, value added to the salmon or to the fisheries industry and the fisheries sector in our province. And the conversation was all happening from an economic perspective. And I said, well, what about the other value add? So the value to the forestry, you know, where they say, you know, up to, you know, 100 meters from the stream, creeks and streams that are deeply impacted by the rush of protein from salmon, the bears, the wolves, you know, are the large, carnivores that we see eating salmon, but then everything else in that ecosystem that is fed by the protein of the salmon to the intense trade networks that have evolved over hundreds, thousands of years in this province with First Nations, not just on the coast, but you know, up and down the rivers. So it is like I said, it is an economic issue. There's no question about it, but it's a social cultural issue and it's an environmental issue. And so when I was looking at a way to kind of bring together and to organize the incredible legislative work that we had, I really wanted to focus on the fact that this is not just about an economic value. It's about a social value, cultural value. Who are we as British Columbians? What does it mean to be a British Columbian? Well, right at the top of that list is salmon is right at the top of that list. What does it mean, you know, from an environmental perspective, when you're looking at a keystone species that basically feeds the province, feeds the oxygen generators, feeds the large carnivores, feeds right down to the bacteria, that's the wild stem. So this is about more than just an economic formula. It's about a complete and sustainable, resilient province where we are looking after the keystone species and they in return look after us. And that really goes back to the First Nations perspective of the salmon, the relationship between the salmon and the human. We have been put here to look after each other, and that is kind of an underlying theme in everything that I've been doing in the legislature, is that we look after them and they look after us. That is part of the original agreement set out by the creator of the Saanich people in those stories. And so it's really a beautiful thing. And when we've got it right, yeah, we can benefit economically from it, no question about it. But we also benefit from having a diverse, amazing place that we live.
So the decline in the salmon stock, could you quantify how big the decline is and what we know about the causes?
Well, in terms of the crash, I mean, I think it's been pretty well documented. Cohen was brought in a few years back. My mind is kind of mushy at this stage for the numbers, but 4 or 5 years ago, Cohen was brought in by the federal government to do a report. I think it was the 2009 returns were so low, just, you know, thousands of fish rather than the millions of fish that they expected. And they looked at the myriad of challenges around what it was that was impacting salmon, why they were basically in free fall. And I think that there are a number of reasons, everything from overfishing to there were some issues that were brought forward about fish farms and disease and sea lice. I think that our forestry practices, how we're treating and managing riparian areas, creeks, streams, rivers, lakes, where we're building our homes and our community development, agricultural practices. And each one of those, you know, we could speak for just a couple of minutes on each one of those and how they impact salmon. And we recognize that the human impacts on wild salmon are wide ranging, broad, and require kind of a whole systemic shift in how we change and how we think and how we operate and how we build our communities and live and operate on the land and in the water. And so this is why I'm saying that if we can get this policy right, this looking after wild salmon, if we can get the public policy right, then we start to do a lot of other things better. And we start to look after our communities and our environment and as well the social cultural values of our province. If we start looking after that, we can increase them as well.
You talked in there about the complexity of the problem and how many different facets mm-hmm. there are. And I think one of the things that has potentially stymied action up until now has been this like jurisdictional question, because as far as I understand the Canadian Constitution as it is, the fisheries and oceans are more of a federal jurisdiction. But as you mentioned, the spillover effects of salmon, you know, come ashore, as it were, and then affect the provincial jurisdiction.
Right.
So whose job is this? And, you know, we'll get into all the stuff that the Sea government is doing, but, you know, what's the federal government's role versus the provincial government's role, in your view, at least?
Well, it's a phenomenal question. It was one that was asked earlier today. And my response to it was, it's all of our responsibility. And it's not one that, you know, like actually what we're looking for, Adam, is we're looking for someone to hold the smoking gun. Actually, it's all of our responsibility. And we can get into that a little bit deeper as we go here. The fact is that there is multiple jurisdictions that all have a piece of this. Like you said, the federal government, the provincial government, municipal governments, which are regulated under the Local Government Act, under the, you know, by the province, First Nations, which are governed, many are governed, most are governed by the Indian Act through the federal government, and all the varying layers of complexity that brings. That's basically then the nightmare that is the Canadian political landscape and trying to figure out who's responsible for what. And what that creates is it creates the kind of narrative that we heard in the that I heard in the legislature in response to a lot of the questions that I was asking, which was, well, Adam, we know that the federal government is responsible for most of this, and we're doing our best to be, you know, to respond to it. And, you know, frankly, my approach to this is it's not good enough to just simply point the fingers and say it's their responsibility. Therefore, you know, and just pass it off. And they say, well, actually, you know, a lot of it's provincial responsibility. And let's just look at this from an example. It's agricultural practices in the province. That's entirely a provincial responsibility to manage that. The Agricultural Land Reserve and the Agricultural Land Commission is a provincial body. But yet we've been straightening creeks and turning them into ditches. We've been removing obstacles in their way in order to get water off the land earlier and to make lands more, the ability to grow food on them for longer. And all, you know, most of those creeks and streams in, especially, you know, in the Fraser River Delta or in southwestern British Columbia, were all salmon creeks and streams. And they were all extremely valuable to this province for other uses other than as ditches. And so when it comes down to asking a question about agriculture and you get the minister standing up and saying, hey, you know, we know that salmon are a federal responsibility. It's, you know, to me, it was frustrating when I hear that and say, well, actually the agricultural impacts on salmon are entirely regulated by the province. That's our responsibility. And if you take a look at, you know, forestry practices, where and how we cut down trees and how we protect riparian areas, or where and how we build our communities. And if a salmon is born in a creek, it lives in that creek. It then moves downstream and then it goes out and does its cycle out in the ocean and it comes back and boom, there's a housing development built on a creek, on their creek, which was now a ditch and there's no place for it to spawn. I think that we recognize that's a provincial responsibility. That's not a federal responsibility. So I think part of what we're trying to do here is say, provincial government, we've got to take responsibility for what we're responsible for. The federal government needs to take responsibility for what is, and that's, you know, fisheries policy is written in the BNA Act, from my understanding, from what I learned today. But ultimately, it's all of our responsibility. We cannot continue to point fingers and lay blame elsewhere. We have to take responsibility for ourselves. In Senchosin language, in the indigenous language that's from my area, Senchosin, it's called Jacinsit. Jacinsit. Growing ourselves up, taking responsibility for ourselves and our actions.
Well, one of the ways the government has responded is to set up a Salmon Farming Advisory Council. Who's on it and why is this an important step in the right direction or not, depending on your point of view?
We proposed and we did a report, I think it was back in May sometime or April, it's all a blur now, called Standing Up for Wild Salmon. And in that we proposed a wild salmon secretariat. What we gleaned from all of the responses that we got from the government was that there are too many fingers in this legislative policymaking pie. We need to go back 20 years. We need to recognize that it was at one point in the 1990s when the NDP were in power the last time, consolidated under one roof with decision-making consolidated in one place so that, you know, the agricultural aspects of it here and the community development aspects of it just, at, you know, 500 meters down the road are in alignment with one another and that salmon are at the center of that decision-making or at least, you know, the continuity is in place. And so we had a Minister of Fisheries, we had Fisheries Renewal BC. And so what we proposed was to create a secretariat, which was a way to create a body that looked after the policy that impacted fish, was wild salmon. The government, Premier Horgan, the Minister of Agriculture, Lana Popham, they got together and they decided to create a Wild Salmon Advisory Committee, which I was appointed to. And that Wild Salmon Advisory Committee was made up of people all throughout the fisheries, the salmon sector. And we were brought together and we met for the first time today and we're creating what's basically an options paper to then deliver to a select standing committee. So an official committee of the legislature that I'm on, the Agriculture, Food and Fish Committee, to then take to consultation so that we can develop a salmon wild, made in DC wild salmon policy, which will really, really help us actually work more closely with and be much more effective critic of the federal government's policies will basically armor the government in its interactions with the DFO, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and the federal government.
So does this council? I would just say
that I think like we didn't propose the advisory council that I'm on. I'm really happy to be on. I'm super stoked that that Premier Horgan appointed me to it. They created this. This is their entity. They've also created the Wild Salmon Secretariat, which we called for. So it should be pointed out that they've created this extra body in order, I think, to provide greater advice to the Premier. It was not a step that we had suggested, but they did actually implement what we did suggest, which was the Wild Salmon Secretariat.
Okay, so just to help me break that down a little bit, the secretariat you wanted exists, and then this council will sort of look at all the advice and sort of, well, I guess advise the Premier, but like, how does the, who's sitting where in this organizational structure?
Sorry. The way I laid this out is kind of confusing, but it is kind of confusing, but there is a Wild Salmon Secretariat, which is bringing, it's the administrative, the bureaucratic side, right? It's trying to bring together the various ministries and policymaking shops under one roof. So it can be, so when policy is being developed, whether it be about transportation infrastructure, climate change and environmental policy, community development, it's being made with a lens of wild salmon, through that lens. This advisory committee has been put together to help develop the wild salmon policy for the province. And it will be the policy that gets basically executed. But this is kind of the public facing. We're going to be taking this options paper to the public for consultation through a formal legislative committee. So this is the public-facing side. The secretariat is the bureaucratic organizing government to make good policy side.
Okay. Is there a concern? One of the criticisms of the BC NDP government has been their reliance on consultations and task forces and councils as almost seeming like a way to dodge doing things. Do you think this is more of a kicking the can down the road, or do you think this is a truly positive way to advance salmon policy in the province?
So,
I mean, it's
look,
really
yeah,
early,
yeah,
right? But
yeah, super early. And you know, the criticism of the BC Liberal government was they consulted about nothing and jammed stuff down people's throats. So yeah, you know, you're looking for a nice balance. You want a government that's empowered to make decisions and be bold, and you want governments that are also engaging and consulting the public to ensure that what they're doing reflects the will of the public as best as possible and is able to recognize where maybe, you know, their approach may not be exactly what the public wants, and they can amend that and make some changes. I would say this. I think that Premier Horgan, BC NDP government, needs to get the public behind them on wild salmon, because you know, we've been dealing with DFO, the First Nations group that I've been from, the Saanich people have been basically harassed by DFO endlessly. We need to organize our voice and get the people of BC behind ideas for a policy in order to implement better salmon policy in the province. And so this consultative process, bringing the stakeholder groups on board early, getting their input, building a policy options paper that can be used to get the public behind. I think that it is quite smart to get the public behind this. Now, it's going to take a lot of work for us. It's a short time frame. This fall, we're going to be taking it to the public, but we need to get them behind it. And I think that this is a good use of a public consultation in order to bring the public along, or say bring them along, but get them involved in this piece, especially considering the fact that there's a federal election and the federal government needs to wake up to the reality of British Columbia, because they've been, you know, despite what the Prime Minister says, he's been sleeping on this one, and it's like they just don't get BC. So this is a good opportunity for us, I think.
All right, so the process is all well and good, but if the government doesn't act on it and does a similar thing to what happened with the MSP task force, where it decides to go its own way before the report even comes out, is that a concern for you?
Sure, it's a concern, but I would say, actually, let me retract that. I would say no. It's that they could do anything they want with this. That's true. They are government. I'm in the middle of this process. I'm really happy that they put me on these boards to be able to, or on this advisory committee, and I'm on the Agriculture, Food, and Fish Committee. Part of my job is to work collaboratively and constructively with government to achieve good outcomes. But I'm also a member of the opposition, and my other job is to hold the government to account in the best way that I can possibly hold them accountable. And so I think that there's a lot of, clearly the government's earned a lot of cynicism and criticism from the public over the years. And I respect the fact that that exists. For me, I'm in the middle of this. I have to look at this from a positive perspective that we're going to get the best outcome. And if it starts to slide, then you're going to know because I'm going to be talking about it. So, I choose to take a very positive outcome. We brought this up last fall. We wanted to talk about fish farms. We wanted to talk about wild salmon. We put a focus on wild salmon because we knew that fish farms were one part of a much broader discussion that needed to happen in this province. We then talked about it day in and day out in the legislature in the spring. And the government moved. And basically delivered in generally what we had been encouraging them to do. So, we've had success on this file. The BC Green Caucus has had success on this file. And it wasn't because we were, it wasn't because we were intensely critical. It was because we found a good way to push and pull at the same time in a way that, was effective. And so we're going to continue to do that. I'm not going to presume that they're going to fail before giving this opportunity a chance to succeed.
Well, before we move on to fish farms, as you just mentioned, how'd the first day of the meetings of the council go? I assume some of it's in confidence, but, is there anything you can tell us about what kind of issues are sort of common ground, or are you optimistic? I mean, it sounds like you're optimistic.
Well, I'm super optimistic. I think there's put it this way. I'm glad that you asked, where the common ground is, because I think forever in this province, the federal government has gotten away with such poor management of the fish stocks by dividing and conquering and having the various groups in the sector fighting over fish. I think that what we have recognized in that group today, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but what I recognized from that group was this understanding that, the fish is the common ground that we all come there. We all come there because we have an interest in that fish, whether it be from an indigenous, a sport, a commercial, conservation, a habitat. No matter what part of the sector you come from, you have a love for this species and for this fish. And so as long as we can stay intensely focused on why we're all there, and we can recognize that everybody else in the room has a valid opinion and a valid reason for being at the table as well, and we respect that, and we can open our eyes up to the other ways that people see these animals, these fish, I think that we're going to be successful. And I think, in this sense, in this time of urgency where we've had crashing fish stocks, I think it's more now in everybody's interest to get this right than it has ever been in the past, which is kind of a sad thing to say. But this is our opportunity, and I'm certainly hoping that we all decide, and it feels like from today that we're all going to decide to exploit that opportunity as best we can.
Well, let's pivot to fish farming. Can you talk about the salmon farming industry in BC, how it's done, and what are the potential risks?
Where to start here? Basically, it started up in the 1990s, maybe slightly earlier than that. The former government, former NDP government, it was there, but it wasn't a primary focus. They were working on Fisheries Renewal BC. They were working on wild salmon fishery. When the Liberal government came in 2001, they made it explicitly clear that they were not going to support the work the NDP were doing. They blew up the fisheries ministry. They blew up Fisheries Renewal BC. They literally shredded documents and got rid of a lot of the science that was done, and they went all in on industry. They went all in on the fin fish aquaculture, what we know as open net pen fish farms. They regulated most of it for the better part of a decade. And then through a legal decision that was made in 2009 or something, 2008 or 2009, it went, the licensing or the of the industry went to the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Kind of a weird thing. Basically, what happens is that the federal government licenses the industry. It also licenses the location of a specific fish farm, and allows them and certifies them to operate. It manages the science on aquaculture, whether it be from genetics or disease. The DFO is responsible for all of that. The definitions of how they're doing the studies, that's all the DFO. Basically, the provincial government piece of this is the land tenures. So this was, you know, up until June the 20th, we heard a lot about the Broughton Archipelago and the 17 fish farm tenures and how the premier could put an end to it. Really, what the Minister of Forest Lands and Natural Resource Operations had was the right to cancel or to not renew, actually, because they were coming up for expiration tenures. And those tenures are basically like your property lines, and they allow an operation which is in compliance with other jurisdictions, whether it be local government or federal government, to pin to the ocean floor, which is provincial jurisdiction. So part of the problem with this whole industry is that the provincial jurisdiction of tenures and the federal jurisdiction of licensing were not in alignment. So the tenure licenses were coming up for expiration on June the 20th, and my understanding is the license to operate from the federal government came up expires in 2022. And so we've got this weird situation in which the provincial government could have not renewed their tenures, which is in fact what they did. They did not renew their tenures, at such case, they revert to this month-to-month situation. They're allowed to exist, but they have to ask every month if they can continue to be there. That's what happened. And they said basically until 2022, which is when your federal piece runs out, you are going to go to month-to-month. And then they created two extra conditions after 2022. If you want to operate, you've got to have a benefit and an agreement to operate in the First Nations territory that you're in. And the DFO, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, must prove that you're not being detrimental to the wild snap. So that's what the announcement was on June the 20th. And for some, it was fine. I was not. There's a few reasons why I'm not happy about this that we could talk about. But generally, it's, you know, a 4-year reprieve for an industry which has been, you know, increasingly the science is showing that it's threatening the wild salmon through viruses. I've seen real virus, the heart skeletal muscle inflammation that creates deformities, and the one that we all have been talking about for a long time, which was really the big one around the Cohen Commission, which was sea lice. And because basically what they're doing is they're farming an invasive foreign species, Atlantic salmon, in the Pacific Ocean. There's an overview.
Right.
I think I got it right.
Yeah, that covered a ton of territory, and it was a big question, right? So
yeah, it was huge. Well,
and the way I sort of think of it, like I grew up on a southern Alberta farm, and we had chickens, and I knew people with cattle and things like that. And you have these situations with large commercial agriculture where you have all of like a monospecies or monoculture, almost like all the same species of cow or whatever. Right. And that close quarters allows diseases to spread easily. And if you're just on one farm, that could be bad. You can have mad cow spread out, you know, mad cow disease spread through your livestock, and you have to put down the whole herd, and that's bad. But when you take that herd and then you have like wild cattle, say, roaming right next to it, you could infect those ones. And that's, I think, the analogy that at least I understand for the salmon issue.
Perfect. And you actually picked out the piece you actually picked out the piece that I didn't get, which is, you know, in these fish farms, they've got, you know, tens of thousands, 40,000 or something salmon per net with, you know, with eight nets side by side by side by side in the Broughton Archipelago, which is the main migratory route of the Fraser River sockeye. So as they're migrating out as juveniles, they become susceptible to sea lice, which Atlantic salmon have at much greater frequency as Pacific salmon do. They're just made differently. The sea lice can't attach as easily to Pacific salmon as they can to Atlantic salmon, something I also learned today. But anyway, so basically what you have is you have juvenile salmon becoming a couple of things. One, susceptible to sea lice and disease that can be passed by these basically underwater feedlots. And also, they become food because they swim through the nets, which the Atlantic salmon are too large to swim out from. And then they become we've got our wild salmon feeding and providing, free feed. The other thing is their excrement begins to pile up, much like on those big farms that you're talking about. They have an issue with the waste, the feces, and just nutrient overloads. And there's, you know, been videos of very, very rare and endangered coral being just covered in Atlantic salmon excrement. The food that is, nobody really knows what the food is because it's all owned by the corporations that feed, you know, that run the salmon. They don't share what's in the food, and it gets basically just sprayed around with sprinklers. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that are created here, and of course, as political commenters and as people who've been watching the politics in BC, certainly you know that this issue has been a highly contentious hot button issue over numbers of years, 5, 10 years, but also just recently in the last couple of weeks and months.
Well, part of the reason it has been contentious is this is a fairly major industry, and especially for some smaller communities, represents a significant part of the local economies. Do you have any concerns that these proposed changes could negatively impact the economy or jobs or the local First Nations that do already have those benefit agreements in place?
Well, I mean, look, I think that the government has to do things carefully, and they have to do things in a planned and strategic way. I think that the decision to go all in on finfish aquaculture was a very similar decision that I'm encouraging the new provincial government to make, the NDP provincial government to make, to reverse the decision that the former Liberal government made, which was to abandon those, a vast majority of those coastal communities and those thousands of jobs in the wild salmon fishery, with an eye to only a few dozen locations, or, you know, 100 more, just slightly over 100 locations where the fish farms are. And so I think that we have to do a couple of things. I think first we have to recognize that there's an opportunity, a tremendous opportunity, to transition this industry on land, and the first jurisdiction to get that right and to invest and to make it happen is going to be able to develop a product that becomes very marketable, and the brand will be very desirable as an eco-friendly, ocean-safe product, and we want to be at the forefront of delivering that. I think secondly, we have to understand that we're in a time of great change in our economy, and this is not going to be the first industry that we are going to have to work with the people who are in that industry to transition them from one thing to another. And transitioning from these workers from on the water to on land is far less involved than many industries that are going to be taken out by the transition and the changing economy. And this is a great opportunity for British Columbia to understand how we can work with industry, how we can work with those workers, how we work with post-secondary institutions and education institutions to transition these workers from one thing to another. I think we get caught in this narrative so often, and at the heart of your question, which is jobs in the economy, that we are going to just have to cling to the status quo because it produces a certain level of economic development. When, you know, it's like saying we are going to cling to the horse and buggy because that's what we know. We have to recognize that there was a whole industry that was coming in, and just as the horse and buggy was going out, the insanity of cleaving to that because that's what we know, became very apparent shortly after. And so our government, we're now dealing with these with technology's disruption in the marketplace that's so profound that government has to become better at learning what areas is acceptable for them to support workers in transition and industry in transition. You know, there's a lot of discussion in these days about corporate welfare and the government getting involved in corporate in corporate business rather than government business. You know, I think there's big opportunities for us to help by creating a regulatory framework for the fish farming industry, the aquaculture industry to operate on land. There's big opportunities for us to help their workers transition and the type of training that may be needed to transition on the land, which might not be that much in this industry, frankly. There's other opportunities that we have to look at around utilities and how we deal with water and power and zoning and all those bylaws that don't necessarily exist right now. This is all work for the government to get involved in and how we could be helping the industry make that transition in our province so that we can protect the values that we have of wild salmon, but also understand that the protein that's created by Atlantic farm salmon is valuable and people for people to eat and for nourishment. So I think that's where I think we need to go with the industry. And when it comes to the jobs in the economy, I think we get really, really, like, it's easy to get trapped in this, oh my goodness, I better not be promoting the loss of jobs. I certainly am not. I'm simply just promoting the fact that we got to get really darn good at helping industries in transition, because there's a lot of industries that are transitioning right now and a lot of disruption in our marketplace.
You mentioned getting BC to become this world leader in like farm salmon done on the land. I know a few other countries are doing farm salmon as well. Norway, some of the Nordic countries.
Yep.
Are any of them showing more sustainable, more environmentally friendly, better ways that we can learn from that you're aware of? Maybe this is too far of a question.
I think that the United States is. The eastern United States has got a very large farmed salmon on land. I think Norway is starting to move in that direction. I think that this is what's important for us is to be, is to start viewing ourselves as leaders in the field of innovation, where we go out to the marketplace of innovators and we challenge them to help us, help government, help industry to transition. And we put that challenge out there to say, hey, we've got this wicked problem, help us solve it. I think that one of the things that we have to recognize, I think, in our province and in our country to a certain extent, we are always comparing ourselves to the lowest value producers or the lowest value refiners. We're saying, oh, it can be done better or it can be done cheaper elsewhere. We'll never compete with that, so let's not even try. You know, my perspective on this is that let's get better at creating better products or the best product. Let's define ourselves and brand ourselves as the highest quality product rather than trying to engage in this race to the bottom and then throw our hands in the air and say, well, let's just ship it raw because, you know what, those folks over there can do it cheaper and they can do more of it and we're never going to compete with them. I don't ever want to compete with them. I only ever want to compete with the absolute best. And so this brand that I'm talking about where we can create a product that is superior and that we can sell it as superior, I think it was under the influence, the marketing show on CBC, where he was talking about this whitefish from Chile that was basically bycatch, and a chef was down there and he ate it and he realized, man, that this takes flavor from everything else around it. It makes that flavor bounce, this fish. And so then he took it back to his kitchen in New York or something like that. And he started selling it for like super huge, like huge dollars you know, and they gave it like this sexy name and they sold it, right? And it was like, that was inspirational to me when I heard that that edition of Under the Influence, because it was like, this is what we need to do. We need to create this brand in this province. We need to take supernatural British Columbia and make it valuable, make it mean something. It means something from a tourism perspective, but what does it mean for wild salmon? It means that, yes, this is the most expensive, delicious, best for you salmon, and you want it because you know we do our business well in this province and we look after the world around us. We look after our people. And this is why you want to buy from British Columbia, not because we're cheapest, bottom of the barrel, race to the bottom, kind of, you know, just trying to compete with the worst.
When we posted that we were interviewing you on Twitter, one of our listeners wanted to know about other controversial salmon fishing methods, such as gill nets that get strung across the Fraser River. Do you support any bans or restrictions on these?
Well, look, I mean, I think that as with every technology, I mean, we just finished talking about a technology which I'd like to see a move into the past and a government that's there to support it. I think that, you know, there's an ancient technology in the Saanich territory where I'm from. It's called a reef net. It's a stationary net technology where you don't go and you don't get bycatch because each one is hand selected. And my ancestors were fishing these with great precision for 1,000 years. And so for me, just because we have this technology from my answer, so you may sound like I'm skirting this. I think that gill netting and seining, there's a lot of bycatch. There's a lot of undesirable aspect to it. Clearly, there's an impact on the Thompson River steelhead, from running at the same time as the chum, as an example. So, like, look, there's a couple things here around conservation. With a crashing species, we are going to have to change our behavior as humans. We cannot continue to operate the same way we've always operated and just say, salmon, blah, right? We have to change our behavior, which means we're going to have to eat less salmon in the short term until we can get, it means we're going to have to catch less. It means we're going to have to work with that industry. So I think that there is a lot of behavioral change. There's a lot of technology change. There's a lot of things that we can learn from the ancient past, and there's ways that we can improve it. And I think gill netting and seining are examples of that.
Was there any other issues? I mean, we've kept you for about 45 minutes, which is probably plenty of time, but is there any other sort of issues around the salmon, wild salmon, salmon industry that we didn't touch on that you would want to get to? Do you want to rant about dams, for example, or anything else that might affect the wild salmon populations?
Oh, okay. So, I mean, there's two. I'll rant about dams. That's fine. I think that the infrastructure that we build, is included in the rant that I did earlier about agriculture and the rant that I did about housing developments and the rant about forests and land management, land use planning, the way we, you know, build roads and culverts and dams. And, you know, we've got to provide those fish access to where they need to go to spawn. And that needs to be part of the planning. There is one aspect of this, which I think is really, really critically important. It's at the center of the Wild Salmon Advisory Council. It's at the center of the Wild Salmon Secretariat, which is what the government has put in place that we were calling for. And that is, this province needs to get a big, booming, powerful voice. And we need to take the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to task, because they have had a lot of the power, and we've, you know, ceded a lot of power to them. We've ceded a lot of power to them. I say we need to take responsibility for what we are responsible for, and we need to hold them accountable for every little last bit that they're responsible for. And if they're not willing to do it, then we need to find a way to take responsibility for this incredibly important, iconic keystone species to our province. And I cannot say in sharp enough language how awful the Department of Fisheries and Oceans has been. Everywhere I go, every group that I talk to, every single stakeholder, you know, it's partly my opinion because of how I felt about the way that they've harassed and harangued and involved themselves in the Saanich people, the people that I'm from on the Saanich Peninsula. But you know, as I've been doing this work, I've been talking to people and say, well, what do you think about the DFO? Awful. What do you think about the DFO? Really poor. What do you think about the DFO? They're ruining it. They're killing fish. You know, I said in an interview that I actually don't think that they, I think that they don't even like fish. I think their preference would be that all the fish would go away, then they don't have to manage them anymore. So I want to be very, very clear, and I've been clear, but I don't feel that they've represented the interests of British Columbia well in the management of their fish, of fish. I think that it's very similar to what went on the East Coast, and they learned absolutely nothing from that. And so this is an opportunity for British Columbia to not only take responsibility for what we are responsible for, but for us to strongly hold to account the federal government, the current federal Liberals, and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans for every single aspect of the stuff that they're responsible for, and make them do their job, which is to, in a much, much better way, represent the interests of British Columbia and look after this important Keystone resource.
Well, Adam, the last thing I want to just say is you've like nailed the job of a provincial politician at blaming the federal government so like strongly and perfectly. And, you know, and I'm not saying you're wrong in any of your criticisms. I don't have the depth of knowledge that you do on this topic, which is why we wanted to talk to you. But I just love that, like, they're wrong. Everyone thinks they're wrong. We should do this in our province. So kudos on doing your job, to the point of how Canadian politicians are supposed to, in a way.
Well, let me say this, and you'll know this. I only did it after taking full responsibility of everything that we've got to do better. So... Mm-hmm. So I have absolutely no problem holding them accountable for what they are. But that is only going to work if we are going to take responsibility for what we are responsible for. Like I said, it goes back to that really key and critical word, discernment, growing ourselves up, taking responsibility for ourselves. And that's what I'm hoping the provincial government does. And then, yeah, we get to bang away on the DFO all day long.
Okay. Finally, if people are interested in learning more about salmon issues, where can they go to look, and also where can they find out more about yourself?
So they can find me at adamolson.ca. you can find me on Twitter at Adam P. Olson. You can find me on Instagram at Adam Philip Olson. You can connect with me all through my website, which is adamolson.ca. I'm on Facebook Live. I do a Facebook Live. I'm starting again on Fridays at 4:30. Every Friday at 4:30, I jump on Facebook and just talk about the week in BC politics. I encourage everybody to come and check me out there. And I'd have much more consistency in my social media handles had I not been just kind of aimlessly wandering around social media and not thinking about what my handles are going to be. So I apologize for that, but you can find me at adamolson.ca and connect with me through all my social there. I do a ton of video work. I might even just jump on a Facebook Live here and talk about this interview, and certainly will when it goes live. But yeah, connect with me, engage with me, ask me questions, hold me accountable, do all those things that is your job as a citizen. And I'm more than happy to work my butt off and do my job as a MLA.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking this time and, you know, filling our heads with all the fishy knowledge we didn't have.
Well, thank you very much for having me and being interested. And I and my colleagues would be happy to hang out with you guys anytime. So thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you.
Well, moving on to our next segment, catching up on BC politics. First off, a couple weeks back now, Greyhound announced they were just gonna stop running all their routes in Western Canada.
Apparently running really shitty buses between cities and treating your customers like cattle is not a profitable business model, and they gave up. So there's no more buses in BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, or Manitoba, except like 20 kilometers
to Seattle.
Yeah, that's the one route they've kept, Vancouver to Seattle. This was somewhat predictable. I think we talked in the fall about Greyhound cutting back service a lot and canceling some of the northern routes, and why that's a terrible idea, especially in the midst of a, you know, murdered and missing Indigenous women inquiry. But, you know, I think
the economics of it weren't great. So this isn't an entirely a surprising bit of news.
Well, and I think Greyhound was hat in hand at the government's door for the last couple months. And corporate welfare is always something we've complained about. And I like it even less when it's a company I don't like. So good riddance. But unfortunately, this is bad news for people in all those communities who now don't have means of getting around unless they own a car, which many people don't. Or, you know, if you're trying to get out of an abusive situation. Following the reduction of bus service in the north, the BC government did announce a BC Bus North pilot project. And I actually look and they have a website showing some of their routes. And it looks pretty good. I think it's like a $25 fee for the first, like, city to city, or if you go to a second zone, it's $45 or something. Like, reasonable fares. They're not cheap, but you're going like a 3-hour bus ride. So
it's been a little while since I've taken a Greyhound, but they, you know, it's not like they were much cheaper than that.
Yeah, so I think it's in that range, but it's more, you know, provincially subsidized. And now there's calls for that to be expanded either by the federal government across all of Western Canada or provincial governments to step up. I think we talked about when Brad Wall canceled the provincial bus service in Northern Saskatchewan, which was equally a, you know, rough idea for people who need that. But it saved their government $17 million a year. The other thing I think the BC government has announced that is for any budding bus entrepreneurs out there, it's a really easy time to start a bus company.
Yeah, they're willing to fast track the permitting application process to get approved for that.
It makes sense. We need more buses out there.
Yeah, it's one of those things I'm not sure I actually don't know how these buses are approved, but I can't imagine the big stumbling block has been having to get the province to sign off on it. There probably just isn't that much demand on a lot of these routes to really make it economically profitable to, like, the last time I took a Greyhound was a couple years back from kind of Victoria to Comox, and there's like 5 people on the bus. Like, there's no way our fares like covered the cost of fuel and like everything and like the driver's salary and everything for that. And, you know, that's on the island. Like, going further up north, I can imagine it's even less.
Well, even some of the profitable routes like Calgary-Edmonton were facing stiffer competition from better services like the Red Arrow that's been running there for a number of years, which is leather seats, assigned seating, you're treated like a human being, and it doesn't cost that much more. So it, you know, Greyhound's business model never really made sense at this point. And it's kind of like Canada Post at some level, I think, where it makes sense that, you know, couriers can do postal service in a city like Vancouver, where there's a ton of movement, but to make sure letter mail can get to Bella Coola, private companies aren't going to fill that gap. And so hopefully we start seeing some plan come together soon for some socialist bus service. But while we're talking about socialism, the BC government has done the thing that I think the right was always fearful and angry about, that they're going to give unions all the power over contracts for future projects across the province. So this is a local benefits agreement proposal that they've set out that for future infrastructure projects, and they're going to start with the new Patello Bridge and apply this to the
highway widening between Kamloops and Alberta.
And I just drove that highway and it's coming along nicely, but there's still some sections in there where I'm like, how are you going to highway widen the Kicking Horse Pass?
I was actually just looking this up today on it, and it's going to cost them like $110 million per kilometer.
Cut a mountain out of the way, I guess.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Cool.
Basically, throw money and a lot of engineers at it.
Cool. I like roads. But they're going to now be built by more essentially union labor.
Well, not essentially union.
Yeah.
Union labor, because anyone who works on these has to be part of a union. That's the new rule that's been put in place. But yeah, the union part's definitely been the most controversial. And I don't think the other local benefit stuff has gotten quite as much pushback. And that's had to do with some training requirements and focus on hiring Indigenous people and women. And, well, I think you could argue that, you know, $1 billion infrastructure is its own local benefit. That hasn't drawn quite as much ire as the union.
Yeah, and I mean, part of this is making sure that it's like local jobs for local communities. So it will increase costs in all of those ways.
And I think the government has been downplaying that quite a bit.
Yeah, because it looks bad if you're the one who's like, we're going to make everything 30% more expensive to build. But they have push back in the way of it's not enough as a government to just, there's a sort of moral argument that like we shouldn't just, you know, race to the bottom, try and undercut everything. Let's actually give good jobs for people and pay them well so that the economy goes better. If you put more money in people's pockets, they can spend more and boost the economy.
Yes, but there are also opportunity costs. And for every additional dollar that these infrastructure projects take up because they're now more expensive, that's some other infrastructure project you're not doing. And that also has costs. And at the same time, I believe the majority of construction labor in this province isn't unionized. So that does create some issues around there.
Well, one of the things about it is I think a lot of stuff is done very short term. And this still has a caveat of like if you're on a site for under 30 days or something, you don't have to be part of the union. But like the day after, you need to be in something. So it seems like one of the inevitable political footballs. When the NDP gets in, they bring this in. When someone else gets in, they tear it up. It's like the Human Rights Commission, apparently, except that one I feel like shouldn't be as partisan.
But this is definitely one of those things where it comes down to different views on what the role unions should have in this. And I'm not sold that forcing everything through unions the best way forward on these.
I'm for it. Let's go.
Yeah, in general, I think the left, and particularly left-wing political parties with labor roots, tend to have a overly rosy view of unions, whereas I tend to see them much more as institutions with their own set of particular incentives that sometimes align with public goods, sometimes don't, and it's a little more nuanced there than I think the NDP and the left sometimes have around unions.
Yeah, and there are definitely better and worse unions, and ones that are more democratic and actually do sort of represent and work for their members. And then there's others that get that hierarchy built in like any human institution.
Yeah, and there's also times where there's inefficiencies that come on construction sites and this, and that we don't want to end up like the Second Avenue subway project in New York, where they have, the exact number was something like 10 times the labor force than a typical subway project has, and that's costing over $1 billion per mile, which is insane for a subway. So like you can have cases where it definitely gets out of hand, and while this doesn't look like that, I think it's nevertheless something that people can be reasonably concerned about.
I guess we'll have to see how this plays out in the actual construction as it goes. The Patello Bridge had already issued a couple estimates of the costs, and we'll see. I think those are in the $1 billion range. And
they just put out the request for qualifications a couple days ago, and that's closing in September, so we might have a better idea after that. Although, even that, you won't be getting the real cost estimates coming out, although the government might be making their own after this.
Well, one thing that's not going to be crossing the Patello Bridge anytime soon are Uber or Lyft cars, as the government has just received a report it had asked for, commissioned is the word I was looking for, on taxi regulations, which is their sort of first step to getting towards ride sharing. Is first we're going to fix a terrible taxi system. And fix is probably too strong of a word.
Yes, because not a huge amount is actually happening in the near term on that. And in fact, Transportation Minister Claire Trevena basically said, yeah, not much is going to happen until fall of 2019.
That's what people figured out, she said, by like the end of the day. When the press release first went out, the ride-sharing lobby was actually thinking, oh, we're going to have it, you know, in the next couple months. And then later she clarified, no, in the fall we're introducing legislation that will change the 6 different acts that need to get changed. And that'll roll out into the new year, and then regulations will propagate, and then probably by the end of next year.
Yeah, and it's worth keeping in mind that this is a government that in their election had promised to have a system in place by the fall of 2017. So we've already overshot that, and it's apparently going to be 2 years by the time there's something in place.
Like Greyhound, I'm not a big fan of Uber as a company, but I think maybe Lyft is a little less evil.
Yeah, and I think it's worth separating a dislike from a particular company from the broader what should the policy be. And the current policy kind of sucks.
Yeah, number one, you're not allowed to do ride sharing, and people are getting ticketed and fined for these sort of underground car services, but the taxi industry is going to get a bunch more taxis as part of the interim step to alleviate the frustration, I guess. The government has announced that something like 500 new licenses will be issued, majority of them going to Metro Vancouver, but
so the majority of anything will be going to Metro Vancouver.
Where most people live anyway.
Yeah, and this is a good step. And while we don't actually in BC have a system that puts a hard cap on taxi licenses, when you apply for one, you actually have to make a case on why this license is needed. And the incumbents in the market get to also show up to that and argue against that. So it's a pretty screwed up way of doing it. Like, can you imagine if to open a restaurant, you had to get the other restaurants on the block to okay you? Like, it's a little baffling.
And I'm not sure if they're planning to change that system at all, but they do have a few other recommendations that they're considering. A lot of them are around insurance requirements and easing that up a little bit, allowing some new fare calculations. Like if you use an app, you can discount it. But one recommendation that's not going forward, the taxi industry was really eager to like be given money to come together as different companies to develop their own app that people would then be able to like call any local taxi from, like Uber, but run by all of the taxis. And the report came out calling this a bad idea, saying the monopoly aspects of the proposal are found to be risky and unnecessary, mainly because all of these companies have apps. And there's been a couple like government or commissioned apps like this that I think I've come across, and they're not generally good. This is one place where you need, you know, just a bunch of tech startups trying different things and one of them eventually work.
So market competition, in other words.
Yeah, but maybe the government would just fund the one that works, but then it wouldn't need funding. So the market works pretty well on the App Store, to be honest.
Pretty well in a lot of cases.
Well, not on Northern bus services. So yeah, there'll be a few more taxis on the road. I still tend to avoid them personally because I always feel like I'm going to die when the taxi driver's doing like 90 or more up Granville Street.
Yeah, I basically don't take taxis either.
And I just got a new
bicycle.
Coming
in like late on a flight or something. Like it's, the services kind of suck. It's not great. Like it's, the taxi industry here is pretty terrible and honestly could use a good shakeup.
But it seems like no one's willing to do the shakeup. So we'll have to keep waiting.
The NDP isn't. The Greens have been shouting loudly about the need to bring this in. And
the NDP was willing to call for a shakeup when they weren't in power. And the Liberals didn't do anything, so.
Yeah, that's definitely.
The Greens are optimistic, but.
It's also worth pointing out in this context that Uber was founded in 2009. So we're coming up on nearly 10 years of Uber being around and this ride sharing being a thing. We should be further along in figuring it out.
10 years is a blink of time in government terms, though. They don't tend to react very quickly.
Yeah, it usually takes a war or something to get quick action. But like, this is the sort of thing that we should be further along in. And the fact that multiple parties haven't done that is not a great sign.
Moving on to segment 3, shuffling the deck chairs on the Trudanic. I tried.
They can't all be winners.
No. Justin Trudeau has done a cabinet shuffle, widely expected to be the new faces or additional faces and better roles maybe that will lead Team Liberal into the 2019 federal election. And it seems like he's kind of gone for a bit more of a pull some of the conservative talking points and issues out from under them before they can use them.
Particularly with the new portfolio that Bill Blair will be handling of
border security and organized crime reduction.
Yeah, that's an interesting package to put together there, and it's been commented on a lot, but like the framing isn't particularly great around the border security thing with the respect of the asylum seekers and questions around the Safe Third Country agreements. It's little more aggressive than I was expecting.
Yeah, the Trudeau Liberals have really cultivated the image of being the welcome to Canada, we love immigrants, everyone come here, send us your refugees branding. The reality is a bit slower and more bureaucratic and basically the same as it was before because not a lot has changed.
If Stephen Harper created a minister of border security and organized crime. I could see that. It seems off-brand for Trudeau.
Yeah, and Bill Blair has his sort of checkered past of, like, the G7 controversies, or was it G20?
I think it was G20.
The protests in Toronto, where he was a bit heavy-handed and the security kind of took over the city. So I guess Trudeau's kind of trying to shore up votes. Maybe the immigration, like, we're not in Quebec, where I think the biggest pressure has been felt.
Yeah, it's being felt a lot more there.
But, you know, maybe that's a political ploy to try to ease some of those concerns.
Maybe. I just can't see it playing well. Like, who gets sold? Is there someone on the fence about this that is going to shift? I'm really trying to picture where the median voter is on this issue and where their lean-ins were before.
Well, and it's one of those, like, Trudeau almost forgot the golden rule of campaigning as a liberal, which is to run from the left and govern from the right, or at least as the NDP likes to criticize. So putting someone in a, you know, historically or typically, stereotypically right-wing portfolio of border security and organized crime and putting those together. So it's not just, we like to build borders. It's, we like to build borders because there are M13s or whatever criminals coming across.
Yeah, it's odd that way. And, like, I could, if it was border security and immigration, border security and refugee resettlement, like, any of those would have steamed more on brand for Trudeau and done the perfect, like, you do the border security and refugee thing, you just split it right down the middle, like the Liberals like to do.
Well, Blair wasn't the only one to get a new job. There was a handful of MPs who were added to cabinet as Trudeau expanded his cabinet. That's often what governments tend to do right before an election, is they start with a small cabinet because they don't know if they have anyone who can actually do their job well. And then you grow it as you realize, oh yeah, Jonathan Wilkinson is actually a reasonably competent MP or someone I want to focus on because Trudeau might be in trouble in BC. So
North Vancouver.
Yeah.
CBC the unseated called him, Andrew Satston for the right. North Vancouver riding.
CBC calls him a Vancouver MP. A bit lazy there. But Jonathan Wilkinson has been given the role of Minister of Fisheries, Oceans, and the Canadian Coast Guard, which is an interesting position.
They were always bundled together.
No, yeah, I'm not questioning.
Or at least they've been bundled together recently.
I'm not questioning the, you know, ministry portfolio, but it's more giving it to him now. Like, he represents a coastal riding. But I think Trudeau has also really been pushing, you know, the Ocean Protection Act and that kind of stuff as his response to concerns here about Kinder Morgan, or I guess it's the Trudeau Trans Mountain Pipeline now.
I think everyone's just calling it the Kinder Morneau Pipeline. It's not what we settled on.
There we go. So putting Wilkinson on Fisheries and Oceans, which, as Adam Olson reminded us, hates fish.
Well, that's what Adam Olson thinks, so Fisheries and Oceans. I think it's a little more nuanced than that.
Yeah. So he gets that job.
And I think it's probably a smart pick that way because it's absolutely going to be a major hot button issue here in the upcoming election, and having somebody from the coast being seen to be on top of it might ease things up a bit. Terry Beach is still going to have one hell of a tough re-election campaign, but, like, it's at least makes it a little better, maybe.
308's probably, Eric Grenier's probably at some point done the calculus of, does being a minister actually help you? Like, incumbency is always an advantage in an election.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about whether or not he'll hold on to the riding. Right. I think he probably likely will. It's more that Terry Beach is, I think, a little more uncertain just because he happens to be in the riding where the pipeline ends. But I think it's more of a, how do the Liberals do in Metro Vancouver, and having a Metro Vancouverite on a important related file might help a bit. And, for example, Jody Rayburn-Wilson, in the riding that starts like a couple blocks from here, barely won her seat. It was a very close...
It was like a three-way race.
It was very close between her and the NDP candidate. And, in fact, the strategic voters called that one wrong. And they all, when they encouraged people to vote for the NDP, and whose name I'm blanking on right now...
I don't remember either.
Richard Solidarity, man. So, like, that riding might be rather tough, and when Wei Yun loses the mayorship, she might try and win her old seat back too and try and fight Harjit Sajjan, and that there's enough people angry at the Liberals that might cost them the seat there just through the vote split. Like, there's potential for several of the local Liberals to lose. I mean, I think Joyce Murray is probably pretty safe, just as
this is a very
safe riding.
Well, aside from Wilkinson, the only other BC MP to change roles a little bit was Carla Quattro, but she kept her same minister but got the portfolio of accessibility. Quattro's a former Paralympian, so she has some direct experience with accessibility issues, so you know, it's a reasonable fit. Otherwise, there's a new, I think it's a new minister of seniors that went to Fiomena Tassi from Hamilton. Mary Ng, who was just elected in a by-election, becomes a minister for small business and export promotion, which, you know, the government's trying to boost up the trade portfolios with a few more mixes around there. And the Ministry of Heritage and Multiculturalism has moved from Melanie Jolie, I believe, to Pablo Rodriguez, who gets a new role. And Jolie instead is going to Minister of Tourism, Official Languages, and La Francophonie.
It's a bit of a demotion and a grab bag portfolio assembled for her.
Well, I know Jolie in the Heritage Ministry has been contested over the last couple of years as they've tried to deal with new media, looking at the CRTC regulations, looking at the CBC, looking at whether to bail out newspapers. All of these things are kind of falling on that desk and none are going great. I don't think any have been bumbled or like electoral reform destroyed, but it's, you know, maybe let's just take that load off your back.
And yeah, there was also apparently the most important show in Quebec did an interview with her that she bombed. That's apparently had lasting repercussions. It was so bad.
I've heard that show's important.
Yeah. I don't pretend to know enough about Quebecois politics and media to really say much more than that, but apparently that's been a issue.
Could see. I think otherwise there's just a lot of little changes around.
There is one other minister who got a demotion that's worth noting. One Justin Trudeau is in fact no longer Minister for Intergovernmental Relations, which, if you remember, he gave himself during the first cabinet, which, okay, like, you know, it was kind of...
I think, wasn't he also the Minister of Youth or something?
Yeah. Never made much sense to me for a prime minister to take on another portfolio just because of how much they are doing.
Intergovernmental affairs, I think there's an argument there that as prime minister, he's the point of contact almost. He's not, but
he's
the face of the federal government. And so if the federal government is working with...
You could say that for any ministry, really, though. Like, it's... I think it's important.
It showed that he cared about working with the provinces. And now that the provinces have elected a bunch of conservative governments that hate him, he doesn't care as much.
Or more specifically, needs someone to focus on managing Doug Ford. Well, he does other stuff.
Like manages Donald Trump, which is why we see people like Jim Carr going to international trade diversification, as in make friends with Europe and China. So there's lots of these little things. I think one interesting one is Amarjeet Sohi, who I believe is an Alberta MP, has moved from infrastructure to natural resources. And the Liberals don't stand a good chance of holding seats in Alberta, especially the four that they had won. But trying to show that they care about oil and natural resources, you know, I could see why they'd appoint Amarjeet, even if he stands a tougher chance than Terry Beach at getting reelected. I mean, if you want to listen to a lot more pontificating on the cabinet shuffle, I know Boys in Short Pants just released an episode talking more about that with friend of both pods, David Moskrop. I think they claim that he's their first returning guest, but I think it was me. But I'm not even 100% sure how many times I've been on their show. I think it's been twice. But, you know, I'm not going to get in my DMs at them. I'm going to just use my own platform to throw shade. So
even more passive aggressive.
Yeah. That's how we do things in podcast world.
So moving on to quit takes. The United Conservative Party isn't quite as united as a Conservative Party anymore because Alberta has a new Conservative Party, and a party of freedom it is. As disgraced former UCP MLA Derek Fildebrandt has announced the creation of the Freedom Conservative Party of Alberta.
I'm actually surprised freedom isn't in all caps, the way he's talked about this party. He's talking about how it's for conservatives, libertarians, and Alberta patriots. I didn't know Alberta patriotism was a thing. I thought you had to be patriotic about your country. Like, you can love your province and even identify with it, but I've never really heard that phrase of, like, Alberta patriots. But Fildebrandt hadn't been in the United Conservative Party for a while since, I don't know exactly when he got kicked out, but it was somewhere between, you know, lying on expense forms, shooting a deer on someone else's property against provincial hunting rules, laws, I mean, or what else did he
get? Driving without a license, I believe.
Yeah, other traffic and violations, and just otherwise, like, shooting his mouth off. So Jason Kenney, leader of the UCP, was quoted going, yeah, I don't care, essentially saying he's a crank and we hate him, so good luck. Derek's plan with his Freedom Conservative Party is to not run against the NDP because he thinks taking them out is the first priority. Instead, he's going to find, like, the ultra-conservative ridings in, like, Medicine Hat and rural Alberta and go after the UCP there and just try to split the vote. And I remember there have been federal elections where there's been, like, an independent conservative running against the federal conservative in Alberta, and they both get, like, 30 to 40% of the vote, and no one else is on the board, really, because it's Alberta, and that's what happens. I mean, you can add this to the Alberta Party, the Green Party of Alberta, which I think still is a thing, the Alberta Liberal Party, which still technically exists. I don't know if they have a leader right now. I think they're in the process of changing. You have a lot of smaller parties there. So it's amusing to me because Fildebrandt is hilarious because he has no power. If he had power, I'd be terrified of him. The other name change that's happening in Alberta is the Calgary Stampede is actually changing the name of Indian Village to Elbow Creek Village. And this is something the Stampede, I wanted to partially mention because I was just at the Calgary Stampede, but has had since 1912. And I learned well there that not only have they had the Indian Village and Indigenous peoples in the Stampede since, but it was actually, like, progressive well ahead of its time, despite the way out of date name in 2018. Guy Wiedek, who founded the Calgary Stampede, went out of his way in 1912 to get local tribes from Treaty 7 to join and participate in the Calgary Stampede and got 1,800 people. But the federal government at the time had a policy of assimilation. And so they'd actually said, no, they can't go do this. And so Guy Wiedek had to get local businesses and people to basically lobby to be allowed to have Indigenous people in the Stampede in 1912, which is incredible. And he did it, and they've had ceremonies there and demonstrations, and it was never exploitative, as far as I can tell. It was always, like, a bought in, like, let's experience each other's culture. And since they've moved the village from when I grew up going to the Stampede, it's grown a lot. And so they have a really good, essentially a circle of teepees where you can go and see teepees from the five different nations that represent Treaty 7 and how they sort of differ. And they have people living in them throughout the Stampede to talk about their culture. So I found all that cool. Although they still called it Indian Village. And I was like, come on. Like, there is Indigenous buy-in for that name. But they, I think, finally recognize tourists don't get it or find it racist. That said, they also still have an Indian princess, which is problematic. And they do a few other, like, races and things that... It's an interesting city, but the fact that, you know, you have Indigenous people who had bought in from day one is something I think Calgary can be properly proud of. So even while they're laughing at the Freedom Party, go Stampede. Over in Ontario, there was a interesting provincial court ruling, which I actually have printed out right next to me on my desk because this relates to my work as well, because I work for a charity. And for the longest time, charities had to be limited in their political activities. So effectively, historically, Canadian charities could do nothing political, whatever that means, and we don't actually know. In the 80s, they brought in a rule that said you can be a little bit political, like if it relates to your mission. And in this specific case, you had a charity called Canada Without Poverty who wanted to end poverty. And their view was handing out soup at a soup kitchen relieves poverty, and that's great, but it's not going to end it. So to end it, they went and lobbied governments, and they trained activists to lobby governments, and they did that kind of stuff. And so the CRA eventually audited them, found almost everything they did was political because they tried to get laws changed, and the charity sued and just won on a freedom of expression grounds. So the judge effectively said, These laws make no sense. They pointed out how the CRA considered the internal time at the charity discussing whether or not an activity would be political to be a political activity, which is fucking asinine. And he goes through other issues like that, and he points out how, like, what is political and what is charitable is a very vague definition. And, like, obviously, like, meeting cabinet members is political, but actually the CRA thinks if you make a presentation to a government committee, that's not a political act unless you're telling your members about it or asking them to do the same. The rules are stupid. They're terrible, but they're gone now. The judge said this section of the Income Tax Act is of no force anymore, at least in Ontario, but it'd be weird if the government applied it elsewhere. The Trudeau Liberals did promise to modernize Canada's charity rules when they were running for office, and they've sort of put that in mandate letters and budgets and throne speeches since. And the farthest they've gotten was a consultation, which said, yeah, delete this rule because it makes no sense. And England got rid of it, and Australia got rid of it, and New Zealand got rid of it, and they're fine. Like, this isn't a Citizens United thing. This isn't...
Yeah, I did hear that concern brought up, and... Oh, do you think there's a chance that this could lead to some money making its way into charities for political purposes?
The thing is, the political activities still have to be related to the charitable purposes. So when you found a charity, you have to tell the CRA what your charity is going to do. And this CRA had never really let people found charities to be political or to change laws effectively. That's why Dying with Dignity Canada lost its charitable status, because the CRA realized, oh, it looks like your entire point was to get the assisted dying laws repealed. So the answer isn't to clamp down on the activities of charities. It's to actually define in law what a charity is, because we're still relying on case law from the 19th century that actually dates back to, like, the Magna Carta. This is real. This is how we run our charities. It's based on 17th century ideas. And so charities have changed in that time. So if we can better stop at the front end people from going in. And look, charities are political right now. The Fraser Institute's a charity. And it claims 0% political activity. And it's never been audited. So I'm fine with opening this up and having the more speech, we'll find better ideas. Because charities are actually required in the documents they produce to make sure they're well-researched, objective. Environmental charities find that it actually goes too far in that they can't just, like, well research and talk about one side of an issue. They have to actually, like, try to justify both sides, which kind of defeats their purpose. But, like, they have to have a false balance almost. But we're still waiting to see what the federal government does in response to this. We're still waiting to see what the federal government does in response to the consultation they commissioned, which said change the law. They could appeal this case. Then, of course, it goes to the Court of Appeal in Ontario. And if it goes on again, it goes to the Supreme Court of Canada, in which case there's no further avenues. I mean, one judge at a lower court will often take some radical stand. Not radical, but they can be a little bit more unpredictable than, say, the Supreme Court. But I'm optimistic. I think this is good. It means I don't have to count arbitrarily how many minutes I spend at work writing a petition versus, like, talking about an issue. So, and I'm not too worried about the religious right or other groups advancing this, because they're already doing stuff. And now we can untie some of the lefty charities.
And finally, we're briefly mentioned Doug Ford's latest hire, a one Gordon Campbell, former BC Premier, has been hired to do a six-week audit of Ontario.
One of the things Doug Ford ran on was this idea of just, like, finding efficiencies to somehow pay for a whole bunch of tax cuts. It's a very Ford-esque. This is what Rob Ford did in Toronto. Well, said he would do, but then didn't.
And then Doug Ford claims he did.
Yeah. So Campbell is going to run around opening all the books, trying to find where the Ontario Liberals wasted money and try to save them a bunch of money. And try to do it all in 6 weeks and get a report out by August 30th, which I think is the most incredible part of this.
Yeah, I feel like you can probably find places the Ontario Liberals wasted money. I mean, not billions of dollars worth that you can just painlessly cut, but, like, it's, there's probably something there, but, like, it's not the sort of thing you can just pull to, like, a province of 13 million people with a big government. You just go through that in a few weeks.
Well, any audit, if you spend enough, you can probably find efficiencies. But the irony is that you'll probably spend more than you save. This is even what, like, the Shawinigate, what was it, the ad scandal that brought down Chrétien found, where they spent all this money investigating that, and they found that the total, like, payouts to these companies were a fraction of what they spent on it. Now, there's a moral argument that the government shouldn't be corrupt and all that.
Or the Senate expenses scandal.
Yeah, that's
cost a lot more to audit than the...
than the few thousand dollars they pissed away.
It's a little more than that, yeah. I think. But, like, yeah. Order of magnitude difference, I believe. Yeah.
But, you know, the Ontario Liberals were famously corrupt, or at least that's what their critics said. It is interesting just to see Gordon Campbell's head pop up, because he didn't take the time to speak to Rob Shaw and Richard Zussman for their book, and I don't really know what he's been up to since he finished his job as Canada's High Commissioner to Britain in 2016, so.
Yeah, sure had stuff to do, but now apparently he hasn't yet another job, so.
Well, he also gave a testimony to this ongoing lawsuit over private health clinics here in BC, but we'll have to get back to that a different time when we've actually studied up on that issue.
The one thing I'm curious is, does Doug Ford know that he just hired the guy who brought in Canada's first carbon tax?
Or who oversaw the government that loosened casino rules that resulted in the massive Vancouver model that we're now famous for? Maybe not the guy you want to be hiring to find corruption and waste.
And that has been Politos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitosPod. Give us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.